Welcome to episode 16 of the Iron Rod Podcast. This is MD, and I'm joined tonight by Searcher. What we're going to be talking about tonight is the succession crisis. This is something that we've all kind of heard about in history. You know, Joseph and Hiram are killed, and the big question becomes, who's going to lead the church? The historical narrative is that, well, obviously the 12 apostles are the ones that take the lead. Brigham is selected and everything is good. The reality is not quite as clear as that. And so tonight, Searcher and I are going to go through what was actually going on. What were some of the things that they could have relied on in the scriptures to help guide them through that process and identify some of the other ramifications of just what happened there. Searcher, before we get started, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I just comment that, you know, we've inherited this notion that Brigham was always the anointed one, that was a slam dunk, and that anybody who rose up to oppose him in that process was somehow an apostate. And yet, on the day that Joseph and Hiram's bodies were wheeled into Nauvoo, it was not at all clear as to who was going to be the successor to Joseph. We had one member of the first presidency still alive. And in fact, the scriptures teach us, and this is kind of little known, but it's sitting in plain sight, really, in our Doctrine and Covenants, which is section 102, verse 11. 102 is actually not a revelation, but it's minutes of an organization of the First High Council in Kirtland in 1834. And here's what it says, and it's referring to the first presidency. In case of the absence of one or both of those who are appointed to assist him, him being Joseph, he has power to preside over the council without an assistant. And in case he himself is absent, the other presidents, in this case that would be Hiram and Sidney, have power to preside in his stead, both or either of them. This particular instruction that's codified in section 102 indicates that if there's one surviving member of the first presidency, then that particular person has the power to preside.
I also was doing some research on this, and I noticed in April of 1834, in the history of the church, Joseph's getting ready to go do some traveling and head down to Missouri and such. And it says that those present then laid their hands upon the head of Elder Rigdon and confirmed upon him the blessings of wisdom and knowledge to preside over the church in my absence. So even in 1834, Joseph, when he was going to be traveling, transferred the authority to Sidney to preside in his absence. That, of course, then makes me think about things like, if these counselors aren't supposed to preside, why do we call them presidents? All three members of the first presidency have the title of president. Why shouldn't they preside?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And in fact, if you fast forward another couple of years, there was an incident in Kirtland where the 12 were kind of taken aback by how they were seated at a particular meeting in Kirtland because they were subordinate to the high council. And they kind of got their backs up over this. And Joseph explained to him that it was just, you know, this is the way he seated them. But then he goes on to say, the 12 are not subject to any other than the first presidency, namely myself, Sidney Rigdon, and Frederick G. Williams. Joseph taught very clearly that the 12 were subordinate to the first presidency. Now, what we've inherited in our history adds a couple of words which are really interesting, and these are added after the fact. I'm going to just reread this quote, and you'll be able to detect what words have been added. And also, the 12 are not subject to any other than the first presidency, namely myself, said the prophet, Sidney Rigdon and Frederick G. Williams, who are now my counselors, and where I am not, there is no first presidency over the 12. That last phrase that says, who are now my counselors, and where I am not, there is no first presidency over the 12, those words are nowhere to be found in the original documents and are clearly an addition that took place when the history of the church was published.
It's sad. I've seen that myself. And that's one thing I'm really grateful that we have the Joseph Smith Papers Project for, is so that we can detect when these changes have been made and realize that these are words that Joseph never said. And once you remove those additional words, everything else that he says conforms to what the scriptures say. And it just makes it so easy. It's only when these additional words are thrown into the mix that we start getting confusion and contradiction.
And do you find anywhere in the scriptures where the 12 have authority, for example, to reconstitute the first presidency?
No. It strikes me as kind of like saying, yeah, we'd like to have the deacons reorganize the priest quorum. The deacons are a lesser body. They don't have the authority to reorganize the priest quorum. And yet somehow the quorum of the 12 took it upon themselves to reorganize the first presidency. And we've talked about this before. During Joseph's entire lifetime, he never pulled from the quorum of the 12 to create his first presidency. As he was replacing counselors, there was not a single one of his counselors that had ever been in the quorum of the 12. There was no precedent for taking members of the quorum of the 12 and putting them into the first presidency.
And I will even just comment that in the case of every counselor that I know of that was called to be Joseph's counselor, that was done by revelation by the Lord. So the Lord never pulled from the quorum of 12 to assign a counselor to Joseph Smith.
Yep. So there was really a lot of uncertainty, as you mentioned, about who was supposed to take over the church when Joseph and Hiram were killed. And Watcher sent us some notes. He cites Michael Quinn in his book. He says, not only did most Mormons not only have the haziest concept of what should transpire in the leadership of the LDS Church if the founding prophet were to die, but between 1834 and 1844, Joseph Smith had by word or action established precedence or authority for 8 possible methods of succession. 1, by a counselor in the first presidency. 2, by special appointment. 3, through the office of associate president. 4, by the presiding patriarch. 5, by the council of 50. 6, by the quorum of the 12 apostles. 7, by the 3 priesthood councils. And 8, by a descendant of Joseph Smith Jr. So Joseph apparently had been going off and saying these things so that once he was dead, there were a lot of people who thought they had a claim to the leadership position, a lot of confusion as to what they were going to do next. And as evidence, the people didn't know what to do. And July and the first part of August was kind of waiting to see what was going to happen. There was no clear direction. The sad part is that the Lord had actually very clearly stated what the succession process should be. And if the people had actually referred back to the scriptures that they had already received, there would have been no question as to how that succession process was supposed to happen. So Doctrine and Covenants section 43 is where the majority of that is contained, and we're going to spend a little bit of time covering that. If we start off in section 43, verse 2, "For behold, verily, verily, I say unto you, that ye have received a commandment for a law unto my church, through him whom I have appointed unto you to receive commandments and revelations from my hand. And this ye shall know assuredly, that there is none other appointed unto you to receive commandments and revelation until he be taken, if he abide in me." So the first part here makes it very clear that there is one person who has been appointed to receive commandments and revelations. And previous revelations tell us that that is Joseph Smith Jr.
Yeah, and I would just insert here that previous revelation that you're talking about, I think, is section 28, verse 2, where it says, "No one shall be appointed to receive commandments and revelations in this church, excepting my servant Joseph Smith Jr., for he receiveth them even as Moses." If we recall, and I know we've talked about this in a prior podcast, that the Lord came down to Moses and actually chastised his brother and his sister, Miriam, because they were claiming prophethood. And he makes it very clear that Moses is the only one that was speaking face to face with the Lord. And so what I interpret this as saying is that Joseph is in that same position. There are prophets with a small p, and then there are prophets with a capital P, that are the ones who talk face-to-face with God and receive his word directly. And I think that's what verse 2 of section 43 is saying, that he is the one that is appointed to receive commandments for the church, And he receives them as Moses did, face to face.
Yep. And it's a commandment and a law that we accept that he is the only one.
Right. In verse 3, you're saying there's none other appointed. And then you get this really interesting if statement at the end of that.
Right? If ye abide in me. Obviously, the Lord is putting a conditional clause in there to say this isn't a given. It doesn't mean that it's always guaranteed. And if he abide in me, well, if he cannot abide in him, well, that means that the prophet could stray. There is a possibility. And of course, if we go through the scriptures, we can find multiple instances where the Lord is warning Joseph that if you're not careful, you will fall, you will be deceived, you will stray. And he keeps calling Joseph to repentance and reminding him to be vigilant. You're the only one, but it's not a sure thing. I got my conditional clause in here if I need it.
And if the God that we believe in sees past, present, and future, he knows what's going to happen, but he's also not going to take away Joseph's agency to make choice. If Joseph hasn't, for example, fallen from grace or ceased to abide in the Lord at the time that this is given, the Lord's not going to say, hey, when you stop to abide in me, he's going to use this sort of if language. So it makes sense. But again, we have multiple warnings, and it all fits within the context of what we've talked about in previous podcasts, that when Joseph steps into this intercessory role and takes upon him the burden of the sins of the people and ceases to abide in the Lord, then this sort of warning completely makes sense within that context.
And that leads us into verse 4, which says, behold, I say unto you, that none else shall be appointed unto this gift except it be through him. For if it be taken from him, he shall not have power except to appoint another in his stead. That's just a really profound statement, that if this prophetic mantle is being taken from Joseph because he doesn't abide in the Lord anymore, that the only power Joseph will have left is to appoint his successor. And there's no other provision for a successor to be appointed. And as you pointed out, the Lord already knows the end from the beginning. He knew that Joseph and Hiram were going to be murdered in Carthage jail on that date. And so as he's giving this law, and he says in verse 5, and this shall be a law unto you, and ye shall not receive the teachings of any that shall come before you as revelations or commandments. They have to be this person that is set apart by Joseph himself. The Lord saw all this, put it in place, and gave us the pattern.
Yeah, and what very few members of the church realize is that Joseph actually appointed a successor before he died. That directly fulfills this prophecy / revelation that we're just reading here. So by definition, if Joseph has appointed a successor, then he has only had power to do that, and by definition, he has fallen from his station because of the fact that he's now appointed a successor. And that happened a year before he was killed, when Joseph got up in General Conference and declared that he was not going to prophesy anymore, that the people had to listen to Hiram, for he had authority. This was a very interesting declaration. I mean, you can imagine the frisson of speculation and activity that this sparked within the community. And in fact, there were some members of the community that came to Joseph. We're not told who they were, but we have reference to them in Joseph's journal about them coming to him and saying, well, Hiram can't be the prophet. You need to be the prophet. But Joseph actually said, you need to follow Hiram. He's going to have a reformation, which again is a very interesting term, because it suggests that there was a need for a reformation, that they had gotten off the path, even though supposedly these higher ordinances that were associated with the temple, what Joseph was introducing, you know, secret knowledge, secret things such as polygamy, celestial marriage, the spiritual wife doctrine, that was all commingled with what was going on in Nauvoo. If this was really the true path, why would there need to be an announcement that we need to have a reformation? It's very interesting to kind of follow that thread and say, well, gosh, why a reformation?
That gets back to the Lord sees the end from the beginning. That reformation word, the Lord revealed that back in the 1820s. And so we have this in the 1833 Book of Commandments version, where the Lord says, "And thus, if the people of this generation harden not their hearts, I will work a reformation among them. And now if this generation do harden their hearts against my word, behold, I will deliver them up to Satan." So the Lord himself uses that reformation word. And we see it again in an unpublished revelation that was given to Joseph in 1834, where the Lord says, "Verily, condemnation resteth upon you who are appointed to lead my church and to be saviors of men, and also upon the church. And there must needs be a repentance and a reformation among you in all things." In 1843, Joseph states that, hey, Hiram's now going to be in charge and he's going to have a reformation. That seems to be fulfillment of these prophecies that the Lord made 10, 15 years earlier.
Yes, absolutely. And then if you continue on in section 43, the Lord tells us why he's giving us these instructions. And I'm reading from verse 6. "And this I give unto you, that you may not be deceived, that you may know that they are not of me." And he's referring to revelations or commandments of those who have not been appointed by Joseph. So actually, let me read 5 and 6 one more time, because ideas connect. "And this shall be a law unto you, that you receive not the teachings of any that shall come before you as revelations or commandments. And this I give unto you, that you may not be deceived, that you may know that they are not of me." And then he goes on in verse 7, "For verily I say unto you, that he that is ordained of me shall come in at the gate and be ordained, as I have told you before, to teach those revelations which you have received and shall receive through him who I have appointed." The Lord's giving us this commandment that says, okay, you're not supposed to receive commandments from anybody who has not been appointed and ordained by Joseph Smith to receive those revelations. This presents a huge challenge to the likes of Brigham Young. I've searched high and low for anywhere in the history where Brigham was actually ordained to be a prophet, seer, and revelator. Have you ever seen anything in any of the historical documents that you've looked at, MD, that suggests that Brigham was ever ordained to that sort of an office?
The only thing I've seen is like back in 1836 in a general conference that I think they used that language one time referring to the entire Quorum of the Twelve, and then they never used it again.
Right. And I know what you're talking about. It was at Kirtland back in 1836 at the dedication of the Kirtland Temple, where the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles were sustained. They were presented and then as a body were sustained as prophets, seers, and revelators. But there's nothing in there that suggests that they were ever ordained or appointed to that sort of a calling. And I hadn't seen anything since there. So that's the only thing in history that suggests a sustaining. But again, we know that a sustaining is different than an ordination and an appointment under the hands of Joseph.
That's a good distinction. So in June of 1841, they actually published in the newspaper, and this can be found in History of the Church, Volume 4, page 364, but it says, "Elder Sidney Rigdon has been ordained a prophet, seer, and revelator." So that's a very clear-cut, definitive answer. Sidney, we know when he was ordained, we know where he was ordained, and we know he was ordained as a prophet, seer, and revelator. We have very clear documentation there. And as you pointed out, we really have nothing for Brigham Young on that matter.
I think it's hard to overstate the importance of Section 43 as the standard that the Lord has set down for succession within the church and receiving revelations. Because essentially what he's saying in verse 6, that you may not be deceived, indicates that deception would arise within the church. You know, this is not somebody outside of the church that's going to be giving revelations to the church. It's somebody inside who would be pretending to receive revelations from the Lord and declaring them. But here we have a very clear standard. I've seen verse 7 used to justify, quote, modern day revelation as they've been ordained. Well, if Brigham Young was never ordained a prophet, seer, and revelator, then how can anybody draw the conclusion that any other prophet since in the church or president of the church since has been ordained a prophet, seer, and revelator? Because we know that only through Joseph or whoever he appoints can that ordination take place. The history just screams silence when it comes to any sort of ordination of anybody. And in fact, shortly after Joseph died, Brigham himself said, "You are now without a prophet present with you in the flesh to guide you. Let no man presume for a moment that Joseph's place will be filled by another, for remember, he stands in his own place and always will." If Brigham had been ordained a prophet, seer, and revelator, you know, one would think that he would say, "Hey, it's me over here. I had this ordination. I'm the guy." But as we'll also see within, the trial of Sidney Rigdon that I think we're going to talk about here in a little bit, that is never asserted as a reason for voting for Brigham. In fact, in the succession crisis, what was argued to the saints on August 8th, which is the day that Sidney got up in front of the saints and the 12 got in front of the saints, the argument for the 12 that the 12 made to the members there was that the 12 should lead the church. It was never that, you know, Brigham was now the prophet and he should lead the church.
And wasn't it specifically that the 12 should lead the church until Joseph's son was old enough to assume the position?
You can see a lot of that in the history, yes. I mean, Brigham makes some comments that I think he's arguing that, well, we're just guardians for the church until Joseph III can rise up and take the place of his father. When Joseph III actually becomes an adult and asserts some authority, Brigham says, "Nah, you're not worthy because you haven't adopted, you know, essentially what they had adopted."
Because you're not a polygamist.
You're not a polygamist. That's right. You don't believe in the doctrine as we believe, so therefore you're not worthy. And so guess what? We just changed our mind.
Then it takes us right back to the warning. "For I give this unto you that ye may not be deceived." Brigham came in and he brought the Adam God doctrine. He brought polygamy. He brought the priesthood ban. You can just go down the list of all of these false doctrines that deceived the people and led them astray. If they had actually followed what section 43 said, we could have avoided all that. The Lord, obviously, great foresight in verse 8, he gives a commandment. "I give unto you a commandment that when ye are assembled together, ye shall instruct and edify each other, that ye may know how to act and direct my church, how to act upon the points of my law and commandments which I had given." And if we had done that and actually founded the whole succession question on section 43, we would have had a very different outcome. But well, the whole process would have been different.
Lest our listeners here think we're just bashing Brigham Young, one of the things to keep in mind is that the Lord allows his people to select their leaders. And he has historically, even in the Old Testament. I'm reminded of the time when Samuel put forth a prophet as someone who would lead the children of Israel. But the children of Israel decided that they wanted a big, tall, handsome guy who looked more like a king by the name of Saul. So he was selected by the people, and the Lord said, "Well, if they're going to reject me, and if they're going to reject essentially a prophet, then give them what they want." So Saul became the legitimate leader, not necessarily somebody that the Lord was entirely pleased with, and he at one point withdrew his mercy from him, as we know from 2 Samuel chapter 7. But he does allow people their agency, their ability to choose. And I know that's not the only example where people of the Lord have essentially rejected a prophet in favor of a king.
Yeah. And that example you just gave is great, because even though that was not the Lord's choice, once the people chose Saul, the Lord did work with them as long as he could until Saul had completely alienated himself with it. So it's not a case of the Lord saying, I refuse to work with this person. He does give you that choice. And in section 124, the Lord goes through and he gives a long list of people. Here's who I want. I want Hiram to be the patriarch, and I want Joseph to be a presiding elder, and I want these 12 guys to be in the quorum of the 12, and I want these 12 guys to be on the high council. And he goes through a whole list of people. And then at the very end, he says, "A commandment I give unto you, that you should fill all these offices and approve of those names which I have mentioned, or else disapprove of them at my general conference. So as you said, the Lord still, even when he's revealing to us, here's who the Lord wants to sit in these positions, he still always gives us the opportunity to approve or reject. We always have our agency and can choose.
And I think the other thing that many people fail to realize is that I think the numbers I've seen is that half or less than half of those who are in Nauvoo followed Brigham Young. And I think we assume that most of them did, but the ones who did were primarily the House of Israel that was grafted in through the missionary efforts of the 12 themselves. And so they probably felt a great deal of loyalty and gratitude to those 12 apostles who had gone over to England and brought so many of them back, you know, into the church, immigrating to America. Those were the people they had relationships with. Those were the people they were tied to. They were their leaders. And so this was all in fulfillment of what the Lord had foreseen with the rejection of the covenant by the Gentile saints when they rejected the law of consecration, and then subsequently the grafting in of the members of the House of Israel into the tree, into the church, for the purposes of preserving the roots. So it's logical that they would select Brigham and his cohorts in the 12 to lead them. They probably didn't know Sidney Rigdon very well, and they followed Brigham all the way to Utah, out into the desert.
Yeah, you look at all of the other branches that were spawned here during the succession crisis. You had the RLDS church, the Strangites. Sidney had his own church. Lyman White had his. Those other offshoots were primarily kind of the Kirtland era members of the church. And then, as you said, the Nauvoo era members of the church were primarily the ones that followed Brigham Young and went west. Most of them knew Brigham and the 12. Sidney, for the last 4 years, had not been a major presence in Nauvoo. And so it was understandable that, like, we don't even know who this guy is. We'll follow these guys because they're the ones that taught us the gospel. So we've already mentioned that in early August, Sidney and Brigham stood before the church and they each made their case. And then it was put up to a vote of the people. Sidney said, "I'll be the guardian of the church." And then Brigham stood up representing the 12. And interesting to note that at that time, he was specifically positioning for the 12 to lead, not for himself as an individual to lead, but for the 12 to lead as a group. And then it was put to a vote, and those in attendance voted to have the 12 take charge of the church. Interestingly enough, we now have stories of miracles happening to validate that vote, but when we start looking at the original documents, we don't see a whole lot of data there. Searcher, you want to share a little bit about that?
There was a really good article that was published, I think over 20 years ago, in Dialogue by Richard S. Van Wagner, called "The Making of a Mormon Myth." I refer any of our listeners to that particular article if they're more interested in this particular subject, because it very clearly outlines the fact that journals on the actual day of when it happened speak nothing about a miracle. You have Wilford Woodruff, you have these other 12 apostles who you would think, if there was such a great miracle that happened on that day, they would have written it down in their journals. Not only that, you actually have people who weren't in Nauvoo on that day later in life writing in their memoirs as if they had been there on that day, telling about this great transformation that took place over Brigham Young, taking on the voice and the appearance of Joseph as if this was some sign from God that he was the chosen one. This miracle story has been perpetuated in the church for so many years that I remember my mother telling me about it. I mean, I heard about it when I was a kid, and, you know, we had some relative there who experienced this thing. We have other leaders there who just said, it was a typical Brigham harangue. But clearly there was a manufactured miracle after the fact, again, to add some credence to Brigham's claim for authority. I think the real contest between Brigham and Sidney revolved around polygamy and what Brigham Young refers to as Joseph's secret measures. I'm just going to read a quick paragraph from my forthcoming book that addresses a little bit of this. Following the meeting where the Saints collectively chose Brigham as president, a bitter Sidney utterly refused to act as counselor to the Quorum of the 12 Apostles and told Brigham a few days later that, quote, the church had not been led by the Lord for a long time, and he should come out and expose the secrets of the church, unquote. Rigdon, like William Marx and William Law, was never supportive of the plurality of wives doctrine and concluded that Joseph had contracted a, quote, whoring spirit, unquote. Given the fact that very few rank and file members knew what was going on behind closed doors in the church hierarchy, this threat of public exposure was not an idle one and could not be tolerated by the 12, who were bent on continuing Joseph's legacy of secret works. Predictably, they disfellowshipped Sidney immediately and proceeded to excommunicate him on September 8, 1844. So that kind of leads us up to this excommunication trial that we have, you know, some information from that we'll now share. But, you know, the big deal between Brigham and Sidney, the 12 in Sidney, was over whether or not to continue practicing polygamy. Do you see that in any other light?
It's sad that it keeps coming back to that polygamy issue. Just so much divisiveness and so little scriptural foundation for it. I'm sure that's one of the reasons why Sidney was so opposed to it, was he knew his scriptures and he knew it was wrong. And I'm sure that's why Brigham and the others feared what would happen, because if Sidney had been put in charge, he would have continued the Reformation and stomped that out and probably done some excommunications of his own to get rid of the polygamists.
It was a small group, and the 12 were a united leadership group that had critical mass and a lot of people behind them. On September 8th, they proceed with this trial, and they invite Sidney to come, and he decides not to come. He doesn't come to his own trial. He claims that he's sick and not feeling well. You know, he'd been sick off and on. Who knows what if that's the real story or not, but perhaps he felt like this was a kangaroo court. As it turns out, it kind of was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it definitely did not follow church parameters. And we have section 102 that gives the specific process that's supposed to be followed for how one of these councils is supposed to be conducted. And there's 12 members of the council, and they're supposed to draw lots. And six of the council is supposed to take the side of the prosecution, and six are supposed to take the side of the defense. And it says it right there in section 102 that the accused is supposed to have this equal representation. And that didn't happen at all. In fact, William Marx was the only person who spoke up in Sidney's favor during this trial. Good thing he did. He said some great things we'll cover here in a minute. But it just highlights how wrong this court was. And not only that, Sidney was a high priest. The only group that can try a high priest is another group of high priests. And as we've already talked about, Brigham Young was not a high priest. He bragged about never being a high priest. So again, we're at this, you know, the deacon telling the priest what to do. We have someone of lower priesthood authority trying to sit in judgment of someone with higher priesthood authority. So it's wrong on so many levels.
And it's a fact that, as taught by Joseph, and very clearly so, the 12 have no jurisdiction in a stake of Zion. And this was in a stake. And so although this trial was pretty much directed behind the scenes by the 12 apostles, ostensibly, they couldn't be the ones actually sitting in judgment. They were supposedly only there as witnesses because they're in a stake of Zion and they have zero jurisdiction.
The ultimate irony is that William Marx, who was the one testifying on Sidney's behalf, was the stake president in Zion. He's the one that was supposed to be in charge.
Correct. President Marx is put in a horrible position. And you can see that he is trying to kind of walk a fine line while defending Sidney in this whole process. Once the prosecution got done, once Brigham and the others of the 12 had been done just trying to cast as much mud as they possibly could on Sidney, President Marks stands up and he says this: "I feel disposed to say a few words in defense of Elder Rigdon. There has been a strong team against him. They all seem to speak against him, and there's nothing said in his favor. I feel to take up the opposite side of the question and say something in his defense, for I have always been a friend to Sidney Rigdon. It has always been the case before this high council that there are two sides to the question. There are some to speak in favor of the accused, but there seems to be only one side to this question. It has always been the case before the High Council that some should speak in the defense of the accused. I feel to volunteer to speak in his behalf. It is no more right that both sides should be represented." He goes on, "In regard to his character, Sidney's character, there are many things said which appear to be objectionable. I hear objections to his authority and to his conduct for 4 or 5 years past. There were charges brought before the conference last fall and 1 or 2 days spent in hearing them. And it seems to me that every exertion was made that could be made to incriminate him and cut him off. There was time given to bring all the charges that could be got at, but there was not a single particle of the charges sustained, if I recollect right, as to proving him guilty of committing any of the acts specified in the charges." Let's just step back and explain the history here. So a year previous to this, at General Conference, I mean, imagine having a trial at General Conference today. Sidney was brought up on charges. There were accusations made against him that he was corresponding with, you know, the disgraced John Bennett and some other people. And this was all presented before the conference. Sidney was exonerated of those charges. And in fact, some of the false history that we have in the record that was placed there by Brigham Young suggests that Joseph actually said, "I have cast him off." I mean, you probably have it there, right?
I was going to make the joke that it depends on which version of the history you read on whether he was exonerated or not. So in the Times and Seasons, which was published at the time, it said President Joseph Smith arose and satisfactorily explained to the congregation the supposed treacherous correspondence with ex-Governor Carlin, which wholly removed suspicion from Elder Sidney Rigdon and from every other person. He expressed entire willingness to have Elder Sidney Rigdon retain his station, provided he would magnify his office and walk and conduct himself in all honesty, righteousness, and integrity, but signified his lack of confidence in his integrity and steadfastness, judging from their past intercourse. When you read in the history of the church, that quotation gets changed, and it says that Joseph Smith arose and explained to the congregation the supposed treacherous correspondence, so we lose the satisfactorily explained. And then that whole removing suspicion from Elder Rigdon gets replaced with an expressed entire lack of confidence in his integrity and steadfastness, judging from their past intercourse.
And then isn't there another line that says, "And I have cast him off of my shoulders. If you want to carry him, go ahead."
President Joseph Smith arose and said, "I have thrown him off my shoulders, and you have again put him on me. You may carry him, but I will not." This does not appear anywhere in the manuscripts. It was added into the history of the church by B.H. Roberts decades later. Complete fabrication.
And yet, if I go today on Wikipedia and look where it talks about a little bit of this history, that quote shows up. If I look at an article, you know, back in 1976 written by Michael Quinn, that shows up. It's only because we have the Joseph Smith papers available to us that we can go back and see, oh my gosh, this was an after the fact addition by B.H. Roberts and Brigham, or, you know, in that manuscript history, that whole process to make Sidney look bad. It's a fabrication, but it's so hard to erase that from our collective history because we've heard it so many times.
Yes.
And it makes it look like Joseph just wanted to get rid of Sidney.
Yep. And so we go back to William Marx, and he's just calling BS on this whole process. You know, if this was a criminal court in the US, it'd be double jeopardy. Hey, he was already tried and found innocent. You can't try him again. And that's exactly what they're trying to do here, is to retry him for things he was already found innocent of.
Yeah. And in fact, I'm just going to continue with what he said at the trial. Now, I think if Brother Rigdon was restored at that time, we ought not to go beyond the conference to fetch up charges today. But here are charges fetched up for years back. It is known that he was restored to full faith and fellowship last fall. I have heard Brother Joseph say repeatedly since that time that all things was right between them. Clearly, the 12 were just trying to drum up any sort of reason to get rid of Sidney. And Marx, with great courage, is standing up to them and saying, listen, this is not fair. I'm the only one defending him. And by the way, you can't put him in double jeopardy. He was exonerated last year. Stop it. Joseph said everything was right with them. What are you guys doing?
Yep. So kangaroo court is definitely the term we would use today for what happened in September of 1844.
And not only that, President Mark talks about how important the first presidency is and that it's a distinct quorum. And here's a quote from the trial. I had always been taught that the first presidency would remain and always be with the church. I have always understood that the church would be imperfect without a quorum of three to stand as the first presidency, and I cannot find any law to say that this quorum should ever be dropped. Because essentially, you know, this is what they're saying. We're just going to eliminate the first presidency. Joseph and Hiram are dead, and we're in the process of excommunicating the one person who remains in that quorum.
And it gets into current church practice, because when the first presidency is dissolved, the remaining members are brought back into the quorum of the 12. Why didn't they do that with Sidney? And I just posted a blog on this. By all the definitions, Sidney had seniority over Brigham if he had been placed into the Quorum of the 12. And so, you know, had we followed back then the process that exists today, Sidney still would have been the one that would have been in charge, not Brigham. We're so inconsistent because we're not following the Lord's rules anymore.
And it was very clear back then that the 12 and the First Presidency were two completely separate quorums, not one. It's only the progression when the 12 started to reconstitute the first presidency under Brigham 3 years later that we get this idea that somehow we draw from the 12 to get to the first presidency. Back then, it was very distinct. And in fact, President Marx says this, I laid my hands on Brother Sidney with Brother Joseph, and he ordained him to be a prophet, seer, and revelator, and to be equal with him in holding the keys and authority of this kingdom. I have known this for 2 years. President Marx knows what we already quoted from Times and Seasons in 1841, that Sidney Rigdon had been ordained a prophet, seer, and revelator. President Marx then actually goes on to talk about how, without a prophet, seer, and revelator, how are we going to get the oracles? How are we going to get revelations? Because this is the means by which we get revelations. This is what he says at the trial. This is what I ever supposed would be the case, that through him, the oracles should be given to another who should be a prophet and a seer and a revelator, and through him to the church. I have always felt since this last conference that the order was not according to this pattern. Sidney Rigdon and Frederick G. Williams were appointed to stand equal with Joseph in this kingdom, and I always supposed that one of them would receive the oracles from Joseph and give them to the church. Now, brethren, I have searched diligently to get at the right of this matter, and I know I am honest and wish to know how it should be. He's talking about this fact that the oracles, the revelations, come through the first presidency. And yet, Brigham is looking to excommunicate the one man who has that authority.
Yeah. The last part here that he says is really telling. You have William Marx, the president of the church in Zion, standing up at a excommunication hearing and reads from the Doctrine and Covenants and says, I never supposed that this quorum could be disorganized while there was one or two left. So this whole notion of just disorganizing the whole thing, he doesn't agree with. Then he goes on and says, I have ever felt that Elder Rigdon sustains his authority, or I've always felt that he sustains his authority. I have never believed that he had lost it through transgression. I believe he is the man to receive the oracles from Brother Joseph and give them to the church. All I want is to have the thing right, and when I believe it is right, I am as ready to confess it as any other man. What a clear, simple statement. That, how do you argue with? He's the president of the church in Zion, and he's saying that Sidney is not guilty of all charges.
And he's doing it through the scriptures. Citing scripture to counteract the smear campaign of the 12 apostles. They don't have a leg to stand on when it comes to scripture. But then he issues a direct challenge in a nice way to the 12. He says, now, is there a man in the church who has received the ordination of a prophet, seer, and revelator? If there is, I want to see him. I think I am knowing to all the ordinations, but I don't know of a man who has been ordained to the office and calling Brother Sidney has. And if he is cut off, who will we have to obtain revelations? A man must be in possession of this power to be able to ordain a prophet and a seer and a revelator. If there is a man ordained to lead this people, I do not know it. I don't believe there are sufficient revelations given to lead this people, and I am fully of the belief that this people cannot build the kingdom except to be done by revelation.
We don't have this in the history of the church, but in the Joseph Smith papers, it says William Marks then dropped the mic and walked off the stage. What a bold assertion. None of you have the authority. If any of you have it, stand up right now and declare it. And of course,
and they all stood up in unison, right? And said, we have the authority. No, it goes completely unrebutted. This assertion completely is unrebutted. Brigham then gets up and continues to attack the character of Sidney. And he claimed that Marx was trying to, quote, soft soap the people. Okay, but he never, ever attempts to rebut this assertion that Sidney was the only prophet, the only seer, the only revelator left in the church. Brigham makes no express claim to authority, to being ordained, to anything like that. Again, if he had been ordained, why didn't he stand up right there and say, hey, it's me, guys. I got it. I'm the man. He doesn't, does he?
This whole argument that Joseph transferred the authority to him and the 12, he never makes those arguments. And if those events had really happened, it would have been very simple. And he could have pointed to the date and to the meeting. They could have pulled the minute meetings up. And none of that's there.
You know, historians, when they look at this, they point to what's become known as Joseph Smith's last charge, which is supposedly a charge that he made to the 12 in the Council of 50, which, again, was not an ecclesiastical body. It was more of a political body looking to build the political kingdom of God in the last days.
It specifically had non-members in it.
It wasn't even 100% Mormon. That's probably a topic for another day, because there are a lot of questions that arise out of the Council of 50. And it's pretty amazing to me that the church has actually released those minutes. But they're available now in the last couple of years. But this last charge supposedly is the basis upon which the 12 claim authority to lead the church. And supposedly Joseph said, I roll off this kingdom upon your shoulders. I can't bear it anymore. You're to bear it off. Something like that. I don't have the quote right in front of me. But this is really an after the fact sort of reminiscence that I think Wilford Woodruff wrote down and said, this was where Joseph told us that we had to bear off the kingdom. And it just raises a lot of questions, because there are no ordinations that take place. There may have been some words that Joseph said, but is that a way that authority can be conveyed? It's not the pattern, is it?
No.
Just somebody saying, hey, I give you authority to go do this. You know, section 43 says one has to be ordained to be able to receive revelations, and yet this is not the case. It's highly suspect that we should point to this last charge, which is an after-the-fact reminiscence and has no record of any ordinations, as the basis for authority. And if there is some authority that's conveyed there, it's probably more of a political kingdom sort of authority to lead, as opposed to an ecclesiastical as a prophet, seer, and revelator mantle to lead.
So after that amazing testimony by William Marks, which was pretty clear cut, I don't see how there was any wiggle room left for the council to make their decision otherwise. But they did, in fact, go ahead and excommunicate Sidney Rigdon on that date. And Sidney very shortly left and moved back to Pennsylvania to live out his years there. And Brigham and the 12 started to coalesce their power and such. In next week's episode, we'll go ahead and continue this and talk a little bit about what Brigham did in those first couple of months after this trial, once Sidney was out of the picture, to consolidate his power base. And then as they're moving across the plains and the eventual restoration of the first presidency with Brigham at its head. Searcher, any other last thoughts you want to say before we wrap up here?
The one thing I would just encourage people to look at if they want to get deeper in this is there's a description of the trial that is available in Times and Seasons. Now, I don't have the exact reference here, but it was published, and you can read some of the quotations or at least the descriptions of what President Marx said. And it's really amazing that we can have access to so many references today that would be so hard to dig up, you know, in the past, but it's there. I just feel a great affinity towards Marx, who was extremely courageous in this whole process. And it cost him. He was released a month later from his position. And I don't know how Brigham pulled that off, except that, you know, the people had voted for the 12 to lead them. So with that as their authority, even though they were not to preside in stakes in Zion, they came into the stake and essentially released President Marx. And he was never excommunicated, but he kind of faded off into the background and actually joined some other groups over the years. I think he spent some time with James Strang and eventually migrated back to Joseph III and part of the reorganized movement. But what great courage he had to stand up in this process and scripturally argue that Sidney was the man. He had the authority. Take a look at that if you're interested. It's in Times and Seasons for, I think, towards the end of 1844, maybe early 1845.
In the meantime, we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.